Throughout history, freethinkers have outraged the religious with their wacky ideas about the virtues of free speech, reason, and of course, eating babies. Now, God is dying, and it's time to dispose of his remains. From the pits of hell, Satan sends two puppets of the imperialist West and the Zionist Jews against God, Islam, and tiny kittens to bring you their propaganda and conspire for a new world order. This is Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment with Ali Rizvi and Armin Navabi.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Secular Jihadist for a Muslim Enlightenment. My name is Ali Rizvi, and today joining me, our guest co-host, is the CEO of Atheist Republic, Suzanne. How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, well, it's really good to have you on, especially for this topic and for the guests that we have today. So last week, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld Texas's anti-abortion law, recent law, that is the most restrictive yet in the United States, which effectively outlaws all abortion beyond 6 weeks, which is really nothing. A lot of people don't even know they're pregnant by the age of at 6 weeks of gestation. So we are going, this has tremendous implications. And Andrew Seidel, our guest, who is a constitutional authority and author of the fantastic book, The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American, is joining us to talk about the future of Roe v. Wade and women's reproductive rights in the United States and what happens next. Andrew, welcome. Thank you for coming on again.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I wish we were here under better circumstances. It's a dire situation, but I appreciate the invite nonetheless.
Right. So let's start with the dire situation that you talked about. Like, So you said that Roe v. Wade is dead.
Yes.
You know, you tweeted that out.
Yes.
So we'll get into that a bit, but for our audience, I mean, because we have an audience that's spread across the world, if you could just give a really quick summary of what this is all about so that everybody's a little oriented.
Sure. So the right to an abortion in the United States is protected under our Constitution. The highest court in the land, the Supreme Court, held that in a case called Roe versus Wade. And basically, they said that they used the trimester system to say that abortions after a certain point might be regulated, but beforehand, you have a right to get an abortion. The Supreme Court amended that slightly in a later case called Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And in that case, basically, the Supreme Court said, look, you can't put an undue burden on a woman's right to get an abortion. That's where we're going to draw the line. And really, we're talking about it changes once the fetus is viable. That is, once it could theoretically live outside the womb. So that is where the law has been for the last really three decades in the United States. But the right to an abortion has existed for 50 years. And Texas came along, and this was in May, and they passed this really restrictive, as you said, anti-abortion law that basically says that once there's a fetal heartbeat, abortions are illegal. And the way that it does that, and you were absolutely right. Fetal heartbeat is, you're talking probably something like 10 days to 2 weeks after a woman would normally have their period, which is what they're calling 6 weeks. I think it's a bad way to describe it. Really, you're talking like 2 weeks after you might know you're pregnant.
Yeah.
10 days, possibly. And the illegal part is a little misleading because this isn't a criminal law. What Texas has done is said there is any citizen in the state can sue somebody else if they have had an abortion after that 6 week period. They can sue the people who provided the abortion. So what they have done is just take out the entire network of medical care, because abortion is medical care. Abortion is health care. And so they have effectively made it impossible for any Texan to get an abortion because nobody's going to provide it because they're going to get sued by this mob of bounty hunters. So there's now a financial incentive for anyone in the state of Texas to prevent women from getting an abortion, from exercising their constitutional rights, from exercising autonomy over their own body. Right. And this is, I mean, it's mob rule over the womb. And I've never seen anything like it. It is straight up draconian.
What is the U.S. Supreme Court trying to tell us? So by taking this and just upholding it, can you get a little bit into the specifics of how they decided?
Because rule on the constitutionality of it. They did what they did on a procedural basis.
Right.
Yes. So
there's a difference.
So the way the case came to the court was on what's called the court's shadow docket. And this is it's the cases that are expedited. They're sort of like the emergency cases that the court needs to hear right away. Often they're, for instance, like death row cases, right? Where America executes people, which is terrible, but they do it. And often there's a last minute challenge. There's one happening right now where the condemned is not being allowed to have their chosen religious consolation as they're being executed. And so that challenge is going up to the Supreme Court. So it's meant to do these sort of emergency relief, things that require immediate attention, because a case can take up to a year or longer to work its way through the Supreme Court system. So there has to be this faster track for emergencies. But those cases are not briefed as much. There's very little argument. There's no oral argument. And the reason we call it the shadow docket is because the decisions kind of happen in the dark. There's no transparency. And the Supreme Court is already sort of known as this really cloistered, opaque institution already. And then this is like one of the more shadowy ways that they operate. And that's what you saw the Supreme Court decide this Texas case on. They did it on the shadow docket. So the Texas law was challenged by a number of abortion rights groups, and the Supreme Court did not act on that challenge, meaning that the law went into effect at midnight on September 1st. And I have to say that is shocking. That is unheard of. I was blown away that the Supreme Court chose to do it that way. And I think an analogy might be helpful for folks here. So if you've paid attention to what our Supreme Court has done during this pandemic, it's like really ready to jump in and act when a Bible study, for instance, is not allowed to meet because there's a public health order in place that prevents in-person Bible studies because, you know, you literally die and then spread this virus to other people and kill other people if you're allowed to do that. And if you put a bounty on people who were going to church on Sunday mornings and worshiping in person, that's the same kind of law that we're talking about here, right? And it is impossible to believe that this Supreme Court would allow the constitutional right to exercise your religion freely to be just destroyed in the same way they have allowed the woman's right to choose to be destroyed in the same way. So that's what happened first. Okay, so the Supreme Court did nothing on the shadow docket. That was the first big blow. And we went through an entire day of this law being in force and everybody wondering how could we possibly get here. And then that night, in the dead of night, in the dark of night, the Supreme Court issued a shadow docket opinion, which is what it was, one paragraph. And they basically said, yeah, this law can definitely go into effect. We're not going to wade into the challenge at all. And if you want to know why that was terrible, you should just go read Justice Sonia Sotomayor's dissent. It's short. It's fantastic. She is more eloquent than I could ever hope to be. She said everything that needed to be said. But yeah, they basically robbed women of their bodily autonomy, robbed Texans of their bodily autonomy in one paragraph.
Yeah, Susanna, go ahead.
Well, I kind of wanted to get into this like vigilante aspect of this law first. So correct me if I'm wrong, but people can call in to a hotline of some kind and basically there's a bounty of like $10,000 to people who report people who are aiding or abetting or performing any sort of abortion outside of, you know, the predetermined window. Did I summarize that correctly?
Yeah, I think that's a fair summary.
And so there's no other abortion law like this in the country. And I'm not actually familiar of there being, I mean, I'm not a lawyer. Are there any other laws like this in general in the country that function in this way where private citizens are the enforcers of the law? Because I know that the Texas legislature designed it specifically in this way where just the citizens are the ones who enforce this law, whereas the state, because that makes the challenge to it much more difficult.
Yes. And so, and that is the real reason they designed it this way. And that is the hook that the Supreme Court hung its single paragraph opinion on. Basically what the Supreme Court said is, look, there's no state actor who is going to enforce this law. Therefore, we have no way to enjoin any of them because the it gets a little complicated, but the vehicle you're bringing the to try to get the injunction before the Supreme Court applies to state actors. So that is why Texas chose to write their law in this way. And I should say too, it's not $10,000. It's not less than $10,000 for each abortion. So, I mean, theoretically it could be more. They also get costs and attorney's fees. So that means if I suspect Ali has in some way knowingly aided or abetted an abortion, and those are pretty vague terms, I can sue him in court. And if I am successful, I get the $10,000. And then he also is paying my attorney and all the court costs and fees. I mean, you're talking, that could be a devastating, easily into the six figures.
That's a basis for that meme, right? About a rapist who, like, if he gets a woman pregnant and the pregnant woman, she wants to have an abortion, he can actually like sue like whoever's doing the abortion and get $10,000.
Yeah. And right?
That's insane.
It is. Yeah. It is. And there's no exceptions for rape. There's no exceptions for incest. It is absolutely draconian. And the other really sinister aspect of this is that there's no care for truth or reality in this. The goal is to overwhelm the abortion healthcare providing system to make it impossible for them to financially operate, right? Because if you're suspected at all, you're going to get hit with lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit, and you're not going to risk that. And knowingly engages in conduct that aids or abets the performance or inducement of an abortion is really, really broad language. You've probably heard that there's, this applies to maybe your Uber or your Lyft driver. If you put in the address for Planned Parenthood and they know that's a Planned Parenthood and are taking you to Planned Parenthood, there's a colorable argument that that is conduct that they know is aiding and abetting the performance or inducement of an abortion, even though most of what Planned Parenthood does is not that. You could go after them. If you are a receptionist who works at Planned Parenthood and you answer the phones and make an appointment for somebody, that's a violation of this. So at every step of the way, there are 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 people who are involved that can each be sued for this money. For this bounty, and then from who you can recover your attorney's fees from as well. So it makes it impossible to be an abortion provider in the state of Texas, and that really is the goal.
And well, the good news is that Lyft and Uber have made statements saying that they're going to cover any attorney's fees or any legal fees for drivers who are found in a situation exactly like that, because they say, you know, drivers have no onus, or they're not supposed to necessarily know why someone is going to any specific location. That's not part of their job, and that's not part of their responsibility. So that's one response that I've liked out of a really horrible situation.
Yes.
And what's crazy about it that we didn't even mention is that you don't even have to be a Texan to start initiating this process against mm-hmm. someone.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Anybody can do it. Yeah. I mean, and again, that goes to the goal, right? The goal is to just completely overwhelm the healthcare system when it comes to this particular procedure. That's the goal. And I mean, I think the vigilantism is really, really terrifying from another aspect too. I mean, the same day that the anti-abortion law went into effect, Texas had a new open carry law that went into effect saying you don't need a permit to open carry a firearm in that state. I mean, if you remember during the presidential election, when Biden's bus was driving in Texas, they ran his bus off the road. Here in Wisconsin, the MAGA folks have lionized Kyle Rittenhouse for killing two people. If you've seen what's happening at school boards across the country, the hatred and the vitriol and the aggression. And then, I mean, again, look back to what happened on January 6th. Right. I mean, they violently assaulted the beating heart of our democracy to overturn the results of a free and fair election.
Right.
I mean, this is mob rule, and that is what they are going for. And I think it really does recall some of the worst of American history. Number of scholars have written now about how this really invokes, you know, the Knight Riders and the KKK and the lynch mobs after the Civil War and Reconstruction. And I don't think they're far off. I mean, this vigilantism is really, really disturbing right. on a number of different levels.
Are there any other laws unrelated to this issue that are enforced in this manner?
I mean, none off the top of my head that I can think of. I mean, okay. you can certainly sue people for, you know, anybody can sue anybody else for, you know, various private torts, for instance, like that. But nothing that not for somebody exercising their constitutional right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because to do that is to rob that person of their constitutional right.
So I wanted to kind of talk about what's happening within the Supreme Court as well. So we know that right now the Supreme Court is, you know, it's a 6-3 conservative majority as it appointed by Republican presidents, like six of the justices, and three of the justices are appointed by Democrats, so they're liberal. Now, Chief Justice John Roberts actually sided with the liberals. At least he didn't join the conservative judges. So this was a 5-4 decision, right? Mm-hmm. So what is Roberts thinking? Is he, because I mean, the thing is, if Roe v. Wade is reversed during Chief Justice Roberts, I guess, time at the court, right? When mm-hmm. he's Chief Justice, that's pretty much all he's going to be remembered for.
Yeah.
This court's going to be remembered for. Is he concerned? Because it seems like he's conscious of that. Is there any hesitancy or what can we sort of glean about what these guys want? Like, we know that they want to overturn Roe v. Wade. We know that.
Yeah.
But is there, there seems to be some hesitancy in terms of how to do it or how to deal with the backlash. Do you sense anything like that happening?
There's two things happening with John Roberts. It's simple. I think it gets simpler if we break it down into ideology and methodology. Okay. John Roberts is a conservative ideologue. He is absolutely with the other five on the court that abortion should be banned, that it should not be a right. In the case where the court upheld marriage equality, the Obergefell versus Hodges case, which said that that equal marriage is a right, even if it's two men that want to get married.
Yeah. He was against that.
Against it, yeah. And it was the only time he ever read a dissent from the bench. Right. The point being, he is a deeply, deeply conservative man and a deeply, deeply conservative judge. Roberts differs in the methodology from the other five in that he understands the Supreme Court's only currency is its public standing, that people view the court as legitimate. And if the court doesn't have that, it's got nothing. And because Roberts understands that, he is an incrementalist. So he wants change to move more slowly. He wants to check every single box on the conservative wish list. He just wants to do it in a way that makes those decisions legitimate in the eyes of the public and makes them stick. And he doesn't view that as possible going, you know, going all out the way these other judges are. So it's the only difference is methodology. And there's also a case before the Supreme Court right now in May. They accepted a case, meaning they're going to decide this case this coming term out of Mississippi called the Jackson v. Dobbs case. And that is basically the court going to fully decide the merits on this and almost certainly come down again against Roe. And I think what Roberts is saying to his colleagues is like, look, why are you doing this now? Why are you doing this on the shadow docket in one paragraph when we can do it the, you know, the right way, and we can go through all the motions of having a proper court case and then gut Roe, you know, basically next May. And I think that was the frustration, if you read his dissenting opinion, that you were sensing there, Ali.
Okay. Yeah. That's, I guess that's not as encouraging.
No, yeah, it should not be encouraging.
Yeah, it's not at all.
No.
I have a question about that case that's coming up in May. So I was reading a lot of stuff you've written about what's going on with reproductive health in the Supreme Court in Religion Dispatches. Mm-hmm. Guys, go check it out. It's very well read or well written. But in that article that you wrote back in May, you basically make the claim that, or you argue that that case has already been decided. Mm-hmm. But when I was reading it, I didn't feel like there was evidence for that claim. Or so could you like provide more background from where you're deriving that opinion?
Yeah. So I think the article you're talking about is where I say first Roe and then contraception. The court's right.
Yes.
Roe. Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, part of this is I am a constitutional attorney. I watched the Supreme Court docket very carefully. I've been in the Supreme Court for oral argument. I read opinions when they come down. I listen to oral arguments the minute the audio is posted. I'm a court observer. I'm writing a book about religious freedom. I was on the team that reviewed Kavanaugh's documents. I was on the team that reviewed a lot of Amy Coney Barrett's history. So I have significant insight into these judges, far more than you could distill down into one, you know, short 800 word op-ed. But I think the best way to kind of make the argument is that Trump and Mitch McConnell, the leader of our Senate, and the groups that pushed these judges, the massive amount of judges under that the Trump administration nominated to the federal judiciary, they did that to put judges on the bench that would overturn Roe. Now, those judges are never going to get on the bench if they say that during their confirmation hearings. So they've come up with all of these different ways to hem and to haw and to elide the fact that they want to overturn Roe. I think the Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health case, which is the one that the Supreme Court decided to take back in May, is going to be the one where, or I thought it was going to be the one where they officially and forever overturned Roe. And I think Amy Coney Barrett was put on the court to be the woman who writes that decision, because then it's much more difficult to say, look, this is an anti-woman decision. Well, how can it be anti-woman if it was written by a woman? So part of it is the other side made it clear and has made it clear for decades that their goal was to overturn Roe and that they were going to nominate judges that were going to do that. And I don't think when they finally got the chance to fully capture the Supreme Court, they were going to waste it on somebody that they weren't 100% sure was going to do what they finally wanted.
So you're not making that claim on the basis of the case itself. More
no, I'm familiarity making it, yes.
With okay.
Yes, no, I think it's the fact that the court is now fully stacked in a way that Roberts can't put the brakes on and make that slow incremental change. Right now, there's five justices who don't care and just want to overturn Roe. They don't care about incremental changes. They want to check all those conservative boxes as quickly as possible. And I think they proved that pretty clearly in a number of their decisions.
And I think, yeah, but people like Clarence Thomas have probably been waiting for this for a very long time.
Yeah, I mean, Thomas and Alito, for sure, they've been desperate to get this done.
There's something I'm noticing just generally about the U.S. political landscape and the U.S. like sort of the political demographics as well, is that Republicans increasingly need to go to sort of, I guess, undemocratic means in order to get elected. So the Electoral College, like, nobody looks at the popular vote anymore. Nobody even looks at it. It's just, you know, it doesn't matter. The one guy got 7 million more votes. What matters is the Electoral College. You have a Senate, right, where you have 52% of the population, right? Or what is it? 18% of the population is represented by 52 senators in the U.S. Okay, so that's, you know, Wyoming has 2 senators, and California, which has a larger population than all of Canada, also has just 2 senators. So you have, that's also sort of an anti-democratic institution. Then you have these Supreme Court judges who are appointed, lifetime appointments, by presidents. I mean, they're not, presidents are elected, but two of the presidents, actually, I think 5 of the Supreme Court judges, the majority of them, were appointed by presidents who had lost the Electoral College, lost the popular vote. In at least one of their elections, right? Mm-hmm. That's Trump and George W. Bush. So it seems like, it feels like that's what the mission that Mitch McConnell's on is, that, you know, they don't have any other way to, and then there's gerrymandering and all that stuff, but they don't have any other way to sort of get their way in the country, because it seems like the population, in terms of the popular, the majority of the population seems to be going in a liberal direction. That'll just continue. So this is the only recourse they have in order to change things around. Now they have a 6-3 majority. So what is there a slippery slope here? Like, you know, right now you've got the abortion rights. What happens next? And yeah, feel free to paint as dire a picture as you can, as long as it's real, because people need to know what this is so they can fight back.
Yeah. I mean, I think the situation is pretty, pretty bleak. They are, and they have been, seeking to enshrine minority rule. They chose the judiciary as the best vehicle for that. It's paying dividends very well right now. To answer your question, I mean, Susanna, you brought up the article I wrote back in May when the court took that Dobbs case out of Mississippi. The point I was making in that article is that you should be scared about Roe, but Roe is just the beginning. You should be scared about women, and Americans should be scared about losing their bodily autonomy, but that's just the beginning. At first, it's going to be the right to choose, and then they're going to be coming for contraception. The case that decided that is the Griswold case. And if you listen to some of the more extreme folks on that side of the aisle, they've been talking about that for a number of years. The Hobby Lobby case was about denying women contraceptives. They said that the contraceptives were abortifacients, meaning that they were abortion-causing drugs, but they were not. Medically and scientifically, they weren't. And the court just accepted this religious belief that they were something they were not, to effectively deny women contraception. So I think that is going to be a coming fight after Roe. I think that marriage equality is possibly on the chopping block too. I already mentioned that John Roberts, the only dissent he ever read from the bench was his dissent in Obergefell. What I mean when I say that is that most of the time judges just publish their opinions. But when a judge really feels strongly about something they've written or about a case, they will often, in open court, when the opinions are announced, they will read parts of the opinion out loud. It doesn't happen all the time. And it does. It's even more remarkable when it happens when the judge doesn't agree with the majority. And the only time that John Roberts has done that, he's been on the court since 2005, for 16 years. The only time he's done that was when the court okayed marriage equality. I think we're quite possibly going to be in a fight for that. We're certainly going to be in a fight where religion is going to be a license to discriminate against LGBTQ folks. And once that is approved, and that's coming around the corner any day now, there's no real way to draw a line between that discrimination and other forms of discrimination, including along the lines of race. Mm-hmm. And if that sounds crazy, religious freedom has been argued to be a license to discriminate against Black people for decades. I mean, the Supreme Court used to laugh that argument off in footnotes. In the Piggy Park case, for instance. But now, when the court okays discrimination against LGBTQ folks in the name of God, there's not going to be a way to draw a line and say, no, you can discriminate against the gays, but not against the Blacks. There's no way to draw that line if you are the Supreme Court. They're going to have an impossible time doing it. And Ali, you're right. It is fundamentally anti-democratic where we are going. 70% of the country agrees that abortion should be a right. A lot of these things that the Supreme Court is going to be doing, or that I fear they're going to be doing, are, again, they're enshrining minority rule. And there are very, very few solutions available to this country. And I worry that we don't have the political will to accomplish them because they're big.
I have a question about the contraception issue. So as you've repeatedly claimed that they're coming for contraception next, mm-hmm. and in a different one of your Religion Dispatches articles, you talk about this, and what you cite is you having a stream on the Freedom From Religion Foundation, and you kind of briefly mention the Affordable Care Act and the contentions around contraception there. Mm-hmm. But can you really expand and like build out what you mean by they're coming for contraception next and what that would look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're really, really interested in this, the Griswold versus Connecticut case, which the year escapes me, so I'm not gonna embarrass myself and get it wrong. But I would go read that case. It's kind of I remember reading it as a law student and being a little bit shocked that like we had to have this conversation, like the people had to fight for the right to be able to take contraception. Married couples had to be able to fight for the right to take contraception. And nowadays that's crazy, right? Like that is a given. Like who are you, state, to tell me I can't do that? I mean, what is this? But it was not that long ago that we had to have that fight. And I think if you go back and you read some of the decisions in the Hobby Lobby case, which was brought under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, it was not brought under the Constitution, or some of the Little Sisters of the Poor cases, what you can see are the crusaders on the other side of this issue desperately seeking a path forward to deny women these rights, doing their best to figure out a way to do that, to prevent the government from giving full and fair access to contraception. And if they're willing to try to do that, what is going to happen if you give them the power? Are they suddenly going to say, yeah, we're okay with free and fair access to contraception? Or are they going to take that power and use it to take the next step, to take the step back to where they all talk about wanting to go, to the 1950s, where, you know, women were subservient and in the kitchen, as the Bible told them to be. So it's... I'll say this. I'm really teasing this out quite a bit and connecting a lot of these dots in the book that I'm writing right now, which is called Weaponizing Religious Freedom, which is going to be out next year sometime, which I know is not soon enough for a lot of folks, and I'm sorry. But it's alarming. And I mean, we're going to fight it every single step of the way, but right now, you have a Supreme Court that seems to be willing to rubber stamp all of these just downright, and this is downright evil and immoral. So I'm alarmed at where we're going.
What do we do? What can people do in response? So Susanna mentioned that Uber and Lyft had put out statements. I mean, you've seen more sort of corporate entities getting in. We saw that with the Black Lives Matter movement. You know, mm-hmm. more people were speaking up. And so a lot of, you know, corporations, companies, they're not really, they're not shying away from expressing their political sort of alignment. So is there anything that can be done, considering, as you said, that 70% of the U.S. population thinks that abortion is a right? What is the backlash against this expected to be, and are there any silver linings?
So there's a couple different things folks can do. One is to donate to some of the local abortion groups on the ground in Texas. I did a video rant about this a couple days ago, and I posted in the video description a number of the groups that are doing really great work. Susanna, if you want to copy and paste that over, feel free to do that. That's one thing that folks can do. Congress, the House especially, is talking about passing the Women's Health Protection Act, which would essentially it would be a federal law saying that women have a right to an abortion, which would help push back on a lot of this, undo some of it in a way. It wouldn't be relying on the Supreme Court to maintain Roe when they clearly don't want to maintain the Roe versus Wade decision when they clearly don't want to. So that would be a step in the right direction. Right now, the Biden administration Department of Justice has announced that it's going to do all within its power to try to help people seeking abortions in Texas. It's announced a number of different ways they're looking to move forward on that. All of that is great. But it all comes back to this Supreme Court again, right? The Women's Health Protection Act is going to eventually, if it's passed and if Joe Biden signs it, and I think it should be, and I think he should, it's going to get challenged in a way there. The states are going to pass laws that violate it and do it deliberately as they've done here. And that is going to get back to the US Supreme Court, who's going to decide the issue at some point. Wherever this goes, we end up back at the US Supreme Court with its 6-3 majority in favor of subjugating women, in favor of mob rule over the womb. The only real solution to this is immediate court expansion and reform, and not just of the Supreme Court, but across all the federal courts. And I mean, I feel like I've been talking about this for years now, and I feel like a broken record, but it seems like folks are finally waking up to the danger. My hope is that it is not too late, that we can muster the political window or political will in the time before a window might close to get the job done.
Yeah. Do you think there's the willpower to expand the court in the current administration? Right, because I'm not getting that sense at all.
Biden's right against it, right?
So what Biden did first was he created a presidential commission on the Supreme Court. And that commission is made up of mostly scholars. I was very pessimistic about the commission from the beginning. We know what needs to happen. We have to create the political will to do that. And one of the ways you do that is by protesting, by calling, by making a stink, by making your voice heard. So I think it's up to us to create the political will to do that. And it's one of the reasons I'm talking about it on your show, and I'm ranting about it on my YouTube channel, and I'm talking about it on the FFRF's channel tomorrow. And like, I mean, we're trying to wake people up to this danger and to get them to lean on their elected officials to do something about it right now. So, I mean, I really am, it's a great question, and I'm afraid that we don't have the political will, but it's also up to us to create it.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, the political will. This is a decision, I think, that may be a wake-up call to people who thought it was, it may not be, you know, like, well, traditionally we don't do that, which isn't true in the first place. But there's a question of, you know, Stephen Breyer, right? Mm-hmm. People saying that he should resign. He's the oldest member of the Supreme Court. And they're afraid that, you know, you'll have a repeat of what happened with Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death. And for this to happen, for him to be replaced with a younger liberal justice, he would have to resign before the 2022 midterms, when there's a risk. Obviously, the Senate majority for Democrats is hanging by thread right now. It's 50-50. And you know, the vice president who's sort of breaking the tie, right? So what do you think of that? Is there going to be more pressure now on Breyer to resign?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I certainly think there is. I certainly think there should be. I would have liked to have seen him out of there already. I get why, personally, why he's not. Like, he's probably having the time of his life right now. He's the, because he's the most senior judge on that side, he gets to decide who writes all the opinions over there. And I'm sure he's loving that. And he also has really bought into the myth of the Supreme Court as a nonpartisan body, to the point where he can't see what the court has become. He can't see that the court has been packed with ideologues and Christian nationalists. He can't see that he is now presiding over this broken institution that is furthering, you know, deeply partisan, deeply conservative goals and essentially minority rule in the United States. And I think he's just blinded to that right now. And this might be a little bit of a wake-up call for him. Things like that have happened in the past to justices. So we'll see.
Do you think he'll resign, though? You think he'll agree?
I certainly hope he does. I also fear that that will take away from some of the political will to expand the courts altogether. That's just me being afraid. That's not really necessarily based on anything. It could go any direction. But I also fully expect obstructionism from the other side, right? Mitch McConnell held open a seat for over a year, not letting Obama fill it, so that they could put, in the end, Neil Gorsuch on the court, who is now one of the six. And I have no doubt that they would love to be able to do something like that again, especially if it was picking off another liberal justice. So, anyway.
I think we should get to some patron questions. And then if we have enough time, I still have more questions for you. Reminder, if you're listening to the audio version of this, you get to watch this live, you get to see the video, and you get to interact with our guest in the live chat and get your question answered. And we also post them on Patreon, so if you can't watch this live, you can ask your questions ahead of time. So D in the live chat is asking, can the Justice Department find a way to counter this?
Yeah, I mean, the Justice Department is looking at a number of different options. Part of the problem is that the other side has been going around and neutering everything that could touch on abortion. A good example is we have something in the United States called the Hyde Amendment. And this is something that goes into every budget law that says no federal funds can be used to fund abortions in any way, shape, or form. So normally funding is a big way that the federal government can throw its weight around, but they're neutered, they're hamstrung when it comes to doing that to further abortion rights. There's a law called the KKK Act, which was passed during Reconstruction, and it essentially says that when a group of people collude to prevent another group of people from prevent a person from exercising their constitutional rights, they can be held liable for that. And it's called the KKK Act because the KKK was intimidating Black voters at the polls. So we made that a crime or something that could that the federal government could step in and stop. But the Supreme Court neutered that when it came to abortion rights in the early 1990s, specifically saying that actually that law doesn't really apply over here. So a lot of the possibilities that you would think might be open to the federal government here have already, there's all these landmines lying around that have been put in place by the pro-life movement already to prevent a lot of that. So they're looking at things like the FACES Act, which is meant to ensure that women have basically a right of way to make it into an abortion provider's clinic so that you can't, protesters can't block people from entering an abortion clinic. They're looking at that as a way to kind of counter this rule. I'm slightly skeptical, and again, I'm deeply skeptical of anything that doesn't get at the root problem, which is we have the courts are packed, the courts are gone, the courts are done. Without court reform, any solution is going to end up being challenged in the courts, and we're right back at square one.
Yeah. And James is asking, can you speak about the tactics that the Satanic Temple are using to fight this?
Yeah. You probably saw something about the Satanic Temple's lawsuit. That's not a new lawsuit against the new Texas law. That's an old lawsuit that they have going on that made it into the news because of this. They also did something somewhat clever with the FDA seeking essentially to remove some of the roadblocks for their members to be able to access contraception and abortion drugs without having to go through FDA hurdles and approvals and things like that. Clever. Good. I think it should absolutely be done. I encourage all kinds of creative solutions and attacks on these moves. The problem is that all of that depends on intellectual consistency from the Supreme Court, from our federal courts. And I think they've shown that they don't quite care about that and that they're willing to adopt that hypocrisy when it favors Christians. And they're certainly going to do that. That being said, showing that the courts favor Christians to the exclusion of religious minorities like the Satanic Temple has a lot of value too. It goes to show that, for instance, the Supreme Court is an illegitimate body handing down these really deeply immoral and erroneous legal opinions. So there's value in that. I don't think it is going to be, and I don't know that Lucien intends it to be the sort of silver bullet that is going to solve these problems. I used to joke that I had one of those, I don't remember the company that did it. It was like Staples or Office Max, one of those companies. They had that like red button that you could put on your desk and you would hit it and the guys would come in.
Yeah.
I had one of those that was TST and I would hit it when I'd get a government that I wanted them to come in and scare. and they would do that. I've done a lot of work with them and I admire them. So
James has another comment here that's kind of interesting where he said, our southern neighbors have decriminalized abortion in their predominantly Roman Catholic country. It's mm-hmm. Mexico. They just recently decriminalized abortion, and we are getting to recriminalize it here. So are we going to see sort of illegal immigrants going from Texas down to Mexico now? Is it going to reverse the flow?
I think that's already happening. I would be shocked if it's not. I guess I shouldn't say I know. I had heard you don't necessarily need to go to an abortion provider to have a procedure. Many of these can be solved with just, you know, taking a couple pills. People have already been tapping, you know, the Mexico pipeline for that already.
Wow. Okay. So let's move on.
Well, and then James just had a cheeky question about Justice Breyer. Like, can you explain why and how he can't see that the Supreme Court is a broken institution
no,
for those of
I
us
can't.
In the back?
I'm not a psychologist. I wish if I could explain it, I would explain it to him. I mean, I will say I think it is part of it is a case of like the slowly boiled frog. This has been happening over time, and he has been on the court the whole time. So he's been in the water, and I think he's in there saying, no, it's fine, as he's being boiled alive. That's just armchair psychology.
I'm curious. That makes sense.
What would you say to someone who was like criticizing you, who would be like, Andrew, you're being an alarmist? Like, if the case was to go before the Supreme Court in a procedurally proper way, mm-hmm. you might be surprised about how they rule on this issue. You're just a radical lib.
mm-hmm. Yeah, I might be surprised. I won't be. It is going to come before the court. It's before the court right now. Go back to rewrite this Texas anti-abortion law as though it were, instead of punishing women or Texans for exercising their right to choose, imagine it were punishing Texans for exercising their freedom of worship, right? All you have to do is look at the way the court has weaponized religious freedom and gone out of its way, tripped over itself to decide these cases. And I wrote another piece for Religion Dispatch where I actually talked about this because there was a case in California where it was a pastor sued over the COVID restrictions, a public health measure meant to stop the spread of a lethal pandemic because it did not let his Bible study meet in person. Right. They were still able to study the Bible via Zoom. They were still able to read the Bible. They could still study it individually. No real burden on their religion. And the public health order was changing in 7 days. And yet the Supreme Court rushed into that case and hurried out an opinion on the shadow docket to squeak in before the order changed. They wanted to step in and defend the right to religious freedom, even though there was no burden on this person's religion. They were desperate to do it. And here, when Texans' bodily autonomy was at stake, they couldn't be bothered to say a thing. And then when they did say something, it was one paragraph. I mean, that to me is just, it's as clear as you can be where they intend to go with this.
When you were going on your rant on your YouTube channel, guys, by the way, check it out. It's Andrew L. Seidel. And it's one of the most eloquent, erudite rants I have ever seen. I was sitting there watching this cooking. I was like, this is so poetic. He's what? Anyways, you say that in this one paragraph, they've rewritten the Constitution, mm-hmm. but you didn't really clarify like what aspect of it. So any specific amendment or...
Yeah, I mean, so that really gets pretty deep into where the right to bodily autonomy is in the Constitution. Where does the right to an abortion, the right to choose, reside in the U.S. Constitution? Which is, there have been entire books written about this. There are certainly many, many law reviews written about this. And there's no specific place where the framers of the Constitution said, you can get an abortion. They talk a lot about privacy and privacy rights, for instance, saying that you have a right to be secure in your property and your person unless the government has a warrant. So, right, that's a right to privacy. Nobody can come into your house unless the government has a warrant. And certainly if the government can't come into your house without a warrant, they can't come into your womb and tell you what to do there. This is a long-standing debate in constitutional law: is where exactly do we cite that right in the U.S. Constitution? And then there's other provisions of the Constitution, amendments that say just because something is not explicitly spelled out here. Just because a right is not explicitly spelled out in the Constitution doesn't mean it doesn't exist and doesn't mean that people don't have it. And other judges, conservative judges, who said that that phrase means nothing. That's a non-entity. It's an ink blot. So I mean, it's a huge debate, and a lot of it traces back to abortion. I'm gonna leave it there. We could do a whole episode on that, like, easily. You get really deep into the philosophy of law, and it's interesting stuff.
I think Mars has one more question, but before that, I wanted to bring this one thing up. Is that is about the ideological purists on the Democratic side. So there is we've seen with the conservatives, you know, everybody made fun of, you know, well, why are the Christian evangelicals supporting Donald Trump? You know, we used to joke about it and, you know, make all kinds of remarks about it online on Twitter and everything. Mm-hmm. It turns out that they were kind of ahead of the game. They knew exactly what they're doing. They're like, you know, we're going to support this guy because this guy, you know, even though he doesn't believe in the stuff that we do, I mean, he really, really wants to.
But change things. Counterpoint, he held up a Bible in front of a church once. I saw him do it. I mean, he gassed
upside protesters. Down. Yeah. Upside down. Yeah.
And he did gas and have protesters beat and things like that so that he could do it. But he was there with a Bible. So
he was there. Yes. Yeah,
so what more do you want from him?
What more do you want? But listen, to Andrew, like, ultimately, these guys were onto something, right? And now they've got the 6-3 majority in the Supreme Court. And it could easily be a 7-2 majority too. I mean, we don't know. It's, you know, depending on what happens with Breyer. So on the Democratic side, there's a lot of bickering going on. There's some, you know, the ideological purists who are sort of more further to the left. They look at just mainstream Democrats as just Republicans. They don't see them as anything different. So is there a way to use this, you know, what's happened with Roe v. Wade and what ultimately will happen with Roe v. Wade, as you're saying, it's going to die.
I mean, I think it's dead, right? Like, yeah, and I'm happy to defend that more if people need it, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. No, I agree with you. I agree. Okay. It's dead. I think it was dead as soon as Ruth Bader Ginsburg died. I was like, okay, that's it. It's over. Mm-hmm. But what is there, like, could this be a wake up call to Democrats? I mean, because people on the further to the left also, I mean, this is not something that they want, but it is a consequence. Like, it can be argued that this is a consequence of the infighting within the Democrats as well.
I mean, it's hard. I certainly hope it is a wake-up call. I mean, I really hope it is a wake-up call. I think part of the problem is that one side has been pursuing power. They see the demographics. They know the way it's changing. They know that they were once this dominant caste, used to that status and privilege, and they are losing that status and privilege. And when that is your mindset, everything is a threat. And it's everything becomes how do you deal with that threat? We're talking fight or flight kind of things right here. So anything becomes justifiable, including anti-democratic, literally anti-democratic leanings. And so I think you're seeing one side pursuing power above all else to stem the loss of their caste, their dominant caste status. And the other side, I think, is pursuing power to create changes, to create to pursue policy goals. So the end goals are policy changes as opposed to power itself to preserve status. And that until that fundamental disconnect is understood clearly, I think we're always going to have a political problem in the United States.
And ultimately, even for policy changes, you do need power.
Yeah, no,
you can't. If you don't have power, you can't do anything. If you're,
of course,
in politics, you can't, and you have to. Yeah. You have to win votes. You can't just win retweets, right?
I mean, yeah, but I mean, and like, look, there's an element of all of this
true.
In, in the anti-abortion law too, right? Like I think I talked about this at the opening of my rant over on YouTube is this law is going to come down the hardest on Black and Brown and poor Texans.
Right. I mean,
and especially when you pair it with that mob enforcement aspect of this, it's not going to stop abortions. It's only going to stop safe abortions. And it's only going to stop safe abortions for the people who can't afford to fly to a freer jurisdiction and get them. It's built in to it's baked in, that maintaining that dominant caste status is baked into laws like these, and to the push to pack the Supreme Court and the federal judiciary. So, yeah, I mean, the answer is I don't know. I certainly hope it is a wake up call, but I genuinely don't know. I wish I were better at reading American politics.
Okay, so yeah, let's go with Mars. He's got the last
Mars
question.
Has a question that gives you a great opportunity for a plug. So Mars is saying, Andrew, The Founding Myth was a great book.
Yeah.
Paperback edition coming out soon.
Not directly related to this topic, but did you get any sense as to how it may have swayed opinion on religion since its release?
Well, thank you so much, Mars. That's very kind of you. I've had just tremendous response for the book. I've had just so many people reach out to me and say nice things about the book and that it changed their minds on certain topics. I've heard from quite a few people who never felt that America was really their country. They felt sort of like outsiders until they read the book. And that's kind of one of the nicest things that I've ever heard about my writing. I've heard from a number of people, who were convinced to change their minds on things, which is also really great to hear as a writer. And yes, it is, there is a paperback version of the book coming out in a couple of weeks. You can pre-order it, right now on Amazon, and it's got a brand new epilogue, that is all about the insurrection on January 6th and how Christian nationalism was really sort of the unifying force from all the different disparate QAnon, white supremacist militia groups that were there. And I really trace that thread through the insurrection and tie it back to a lot of the disinformation that has been deliberately pushed, and that I debunked in The Founding Myth, which ties up into this Christian nationalist identity. So I'm really excited for that to come out.
I was actually thinking of you when that happened. We saw all of the religious nationalist aspects the January 6th stuff. And I was thinking of The Founding Myth. I had an early chance to read it.
You did. You were kind of to blurb it. Yeah,
I blurbed it. It was amazing. It's like I still think I recommend it to people all the time. I think it's just fantastic. I don't think there's anything else like that out there that really spells it out. And you've researched it so meticulously. So I'm really looking forward to your next book as well.
Thank you. I really appreciate
it. And again,
that.
So everybody, yeah, the paperback for The Founding Myth is out. And I'm going to get it now just for the epilogue. So I want to see what you wrote about it.
Yes, I'm excited. So guys, if you're interested in hearing more from Andrew, you can follow him on Twitter at Andrew L. Seidel. Are there any other places? Well, also the YouTube channel, same name. And you make frequent appearances on the Freedom From Religion Foundation YouTube channel. But most especially, definitely go support the Freedom From Religion Foundation. I say on Atheist Republic all the time that they're one of the most important organizations in our entire country. Like, these attorneys are on the front lines of putting in these work that help preserve the preservation of the separation of church and state. And so important. And Andrew is the director of strategic response there. So, you're also supporting him.
I'm blushing over here. Those are really kind words. We FFRF needs all the support we can get even now. It was a rough 4 years. We're still playing defense now with this court. I really appreciate that and the kind words and always the chance to come on and chat. It's so fun. I really enjoy being on.
I don't know if you ever want to come by when there's like better circumstances, you can. It doesn't have to be during the worst of times.
Yeah, no, I'd love to. I would love to do that. I do prefer the Chicken Little thing. You know, I like to let everybody know that the sky is falling when it is. But I should do a I Told You So lap at some point. Because right. that'll be all I have left at some point. So
you got to entertain yourself.
You got to share your victories as well.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, but it's just, I mean, it's a Handmaid's Tale scenario. I mean, everything you're describing, it really does feel like that. And they talk about the incremental, well, I mean, you were talking about incrementalism in a different context with John Roberts, but like that sort of incremental downward slide.
Yeah. I mean the mob rule aspect of it too, and the inform on your loved ones, inform on your friends is really it's really got that dystopian feel to it.
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, thank you very much. Andrew, thank you for everybody who joined here live. Thank you very much. Remember, if you like what you hear here and you like hearing from our guests and this show, please do consider going to patreon.com/SJME and becoming a patron for as little as $1 a month, where you will get 5 to 6 episodes. You get to watch them live. If you have questions, you can ask your questions in advance on the Patreon page, and we will read your questions first and address them first. And if not, you can ask your questions live and you can join in. You can engage with our guests and with us. And yeah, I think if you're watching this on YouTube, please hit the like button.
And like share. You know, and it's share. Free. It helps the show out a lot. And, you know, it doesn't cost you a thing.
And hit the subscribe button, hit the bell so you're notified every time there's a new video. And we always have like cool, interesting clips of videos coming out regularly. So, yeah, that's pretty much it. And if you're listening to it on iTunes or any your podcast app, please give us a rating. And yeah, Andrew, thank you. This is.
Yes, thank you, Andrew. Fantastic. It was excellent.
Literally anytime. Yeah, I'm glad we were able to set this up. So anytime you want to do it, let me know.
Yay! Well, have a good night, everyone.
All right. Bye bye.
The secular jihadists have been made possible thanks to the Illuminati and the covert support of Israel and the CIA. That's what we have been told, but we haven't received our checks yet. If you like what we do, please support us. Share the podcast with your friends. Write and tweet us with topic and guest suggestions. Or head over to secularjihadist.com and give $1 or more for exclusive access to live video. Have your questions read and answered on the air and more. Till next time, may the flying spaghetti monster be with you.